Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone. I'm Neil Haley, the Total Tutor, and I'm really excited to get the honor to be asked to co-host a show with somebody who I consider a mentor of mine in many, many ways. It's amazing. When I started out in college radio 3 years ago, I met Dr. Shelley Hipsky, and she absolutely made me be more motivated to shoot for the moon and go farther in my radio network, as you know, with all the syndication I have. But now we've decided to come back together again to do a radio show together, empowering women. So I'm really, really excited to welcome the program, Dr. Shelley Hipsky. Dr. Shelley, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm so delighted that we're going to be uplifting, inspiring, and empowering women through this new show. My television show, Inspiring Lives with Dr. Shelley, has had a pretty profound impact globally, as well as my fifth book, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Planet. And I've just met these incredible people from around the globe. And one of them we actually have with us here today, and she has had some just absolutely amazing experiences from her WIS program in Africa, which she'll be able to talk to you about, but also as a PhD and a background in psychology and international relations. She has just done amazing work with that. But, Neil, the reason that I needed to get her on this show immediately was the experience that she just had a week ago. And, Joanna, I'd like to welcome you to Empowering Women. And we're going to begin sort of with the hard stuff. You know how I roll with my shows. What happened a week ago there in Boston? I mean, people know, but take us back.
Well, first, thanks so much for having me on here. It is always a pleasure to be able to talk to you and just be a part of anything you're doing. The work
Thank you.
Is so spectacular. I am a big proponent of doing virtually anything you can to create a better place. Wow. Last week was quite a ride. I was at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah.
And two people actually tried to blow us up.
Yeah.
As a community. And as a community, we prevailed.
Amazing. And, you know, the world watched as Boston went through this incredible tragedy, and then we also watched Boston and everyone that was there from all around just pick each other back up and help and join together. So I know that you wanted to talk more about not the evil of that day, but the amazingly empowering moments and the togetherness moments. Can we sort of jump ahead to that? You took us back a little, but where's your heart today? A week later.
Yeah, today my heart is in a lot of places. And you're correct. I did want to focus more on the people, because the truth is that the world is going to be chaotic, and the world is going to be evil, and there will always be crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And if we continue to focus on the people who create the evil or who create crisis situations, then we forget about all the good that comes out of them or the good that is around us every day. And one of the most amazing things that I have really been focusing on, and that certainly has been a hallmark in my life and really came to the forefront in this event, is just the overwhelming amount of support and love that was seen at that event.
Mm-hmm.
And in the outpouring from the world. I mean, I was 10 feet from the blast, and I would have been literally sitting on top of the second bomb.
Oh, wow.
I actually just came from my doctor's right before I got on the phone with you, and I have some hearing loss. I physically am lucky to be unscathed, but the people who are standing right near where I was were not so lucky, and I immediately started triage. Nobody quite prepares somebody for cheering one moment and tying off wounded legs and arms the next. You don't. You know, it's something that the mind can't comprehend. And when these kinds of things happen and everybody pulls together.
Yes.
And you have people triaging left and right, and you have people carrying new victims over to me so I can look at their, you know, their ankles and their ears and their legs, and people are ripping off their shirts and saying, here, use this as a tourniquet. And you understand that these heroes and angels are just walking amongst us.
Absolutely. Dr. Joanna, I want to ask a question really quickly. Specifically, a lot of people talk about when you have those situations that occur where it's a crisis and how you handle it right after it happened. How is it that so many people were able to just move so quickly and save so many people's lives in such a fast fashion when it was so traumatic?
It's so funny. I think some people are for me at least, I'm always good in a crisis. I always have been since I was a kid. And some people just really are naturally good in crisis. I do, however, really believe, though, that people really do reach out, and people actually care about not wanting the person next to them to bleed to death.
That's great.
And we forget that the essential nature of humankind is not to want to blow somebody up, but is to want to reach out. And we've just forgot. We've gotten out of the habit. Because we've stopped doing these little niceties every day to each other, as we've gotten self-consumed, we've stopped forgetting to give the homeless guy a dollar. We've stopped forgetting to do these things. We forget the larger issues as well. Like, gee, I can actually go over and, you know, help pick that kid up. I can actually go over and help that person in a crisis. But we can help all the time in every way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I was at first heartbroken for you when I heard what you had been through, and then really uplifted, Dr. Joanna, because I knew that you were there to help people, even though you didn't know that day that was going to be something you were going to do. I was pleased that there was somebody like yourself, and then we saw on the TV and in the news so many other people, angels like you called them, at the Boston Marathon just taking care of business and helping each other, and that was just amazingly empowering to see.
It is so empowering when you realize that you never need to be helpless. Because,
right.
I think that's really what it is. There are a lot of people that feel helpless,
mm-hmm.
and they think, oh, my God, what can I do when crisis hits? Or, you know, what can I do when my life falls apart? And I think the real answer is, well, you can go help.
So what you're saying is, if you're feeling helpless, the best thing to do is to go out and help someone else. Is that correct?
Exactly. And it's not, you know, in the crisis situation, you didn't have to go tourniquet a leg. You didn't have to do the job of a first responder. You could offer somebody water, offer them a hug, offer them rides. Tons of people opened their homes to stranded runners. People offered jackets when other people were shivering. Restaurants, free food, water. People were waving other people away from the bombs. I mean, it was the outpouring of the century.
I love it.
And
I love it.
What's interesting, Dr. Shelley, that we're hearing from her is that, again, everyone pulled together. Everyone, and there had to be leaders there. And that's the question I want to ask Dr. Joanne. Who kind of stepped up as leaders? Because, you know, you have a lot of people that will grab the water, will open up their homes, but there's others that just, you know, spring into action and are able to do it. Could you spot specifically how they were able to do that? Or did you guys, because you don't want organized, you want organized chaos. You don't want chaos to the point where things just don't get done.
Well, I exactly see what you're saying. The interesting part about this is that Boston is a great community in the sense that it's a real community. We're very tight-knit, but we're usually tight-knit in terms of everybody kind of sticks to their own, and they stick to them very deeply. But what happens is, in this kind of scene, certainly in the first few moments, there was chaos, and it was total chaos. The first responders had not been able to get to the scene yet. The ambulances were not there yet. And what you really found was that everyday people, just like me, I immediately turned and I started a triage area. Everyday people ran and just started doing exactly what they could. People said, go that way, get away from it. It was kind of just everyday people. Maybe they had been ex-Marines. Maybe they had been school teachers who knew how to handle unruly children.
We can appreciate that, right, Neil?
Yes, absolutely.
We're both educators, so we get that.
There were everyday people who, for whatever their role in life, they just stepped up and did what they knew how to do in a situation. And we all have different capacities. And some people, like restaurant people, they did what they knew how to do. Hey, we cook. We know how to give people food. Other people, hey, we have a house. We can handle a couple of runners staying here. We know how to do that. And that's really the point. Yes, it was a chaos, of course. Once the first responders got on the scene, though, you know, they started to organize it, too. I think the real point is that everybody tried to step up and do what they could to organize that chaos and do the right thing. And that's what's so important, because the world does need leaders to do that. But when people actually step up and take that role and realize that this is their world, this is their community, this is their society, and they have a right to take a part in it and create the kind of society that they want to live in every day and make it better and have a positive impact.
Absolutely, That's it. Well, absolutely, and I think that what we're learning from you in this situation is that, again, it's so fast. It moves so quickly when something like this happens. I mean, I saw it firsthand in an airplane with one person, but how 8 to 10 people after someone fainted were just on it, and it was like everyone was moving, and everyone jumped out of their seats, and then someone told them to stop. It was very not exactly like what happened there, but it's just like people are human beings that see that that were made to help each other. And when there's a crisis, everyone jumps in. So when we get back, we're going to be more with Dr. Shelley Hipsky, learning more about Dr. Joanne's experience, and then also learn about some of the other great work she's doing. And Dr. Shelley, I tell you, this is a fun thing because we're really learning how people are great leaders to help others, and especially empowering women. So we'll be back with Dr. Shelley Hipsky and Dr. Joanne in just a moment. We're back to empowering women with Dr. Shelley Hipsky, and so far learning a lot about what happened in Boston firsthand. The news isn't able to really tell you what the people did, the first responders, but also I'm learning more about just the average everyday people going ahead, Dr. Shelley, and really pitching in to help in a situation that could have been really a lot worse.
Absolutely, and it thrills me. You know, my company's Inspiring Lives, and we are all about finding people and their gifts and their strengths and letting them run with it and help other people. So while this was a tragedy and there was evil seen that day, I think that we saw so many people just jump into their being and their element and their skill set and using them to help other people right there on the spot. I've always been amazed, Dr. Joanna, you know, we go back. So I've always been amazed with your work you've done in leadership as president of Friends of WIS. And I know that that's going to be changing to Moyo International on May 1st. I'd love to let my listening audience know more about your 501c3 charitable organization and what you do for the women of Tanzania, Africa, because that's just fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
You know, giving back has always been just a huge passion of mine. This whole conversation here has been about trying to create the kind of society that you want to live in.
Yeah.
And it can be done mindfully in so many ways, whether it is through small acts or large acts. And, you know, I constantly tell people that you don't have to go be Mother Teresa living in Calcutta to donate $5, you know, to change the kind of society globally that you want to be in. You don't have to have hero in your job description to be a hero to somebody on the street every day. And, you know, with the work that we do at Friends of WIS, which, you know, like you said, will soon be turning into Moyo, what I try to do is construct truly relevant poverty reduction strategies. And I've just found it to be so such a worthy piece of my life that has it changed my life for the better.
And I know you've been to Africa to help there on site. Can you describe one of your favorite moments there in Africa helping?
God, there are so many.
I know there are. It's hard to load a question, right?
Actually, do you want to hear something? You want to hear something really silly?
Yeah.
My favorite part, right? Because I can tell you right now, my favorite part is knowing that the work we do is transcendent. It's not when you give, you always just give selflessly. You never expect anything in return.
Right.
Yet. When this whole thing in Boston happened, I was flooded with emails and calls from friends in Tanzania, people that we have helped, families, organizations that we work with there, wanting to know if I was okay.
And beautiful. They're checking in on you. You're important to them.
This is from across the world. Half of these people don't get electricity. I mean, we're talking about a country where there's no electricity most of the time.
How are they getting these phones and the computers? Are they walking long distances to try to reach out to you?
Well, yeah, actually they are. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that in urban areas, you know, there's rarely electricity, and very occasionally, you know, there will be a news program around. And so the idea that one person has heard something and everybody reaches out and goes and notifies everybody else, and then everybody is concerned, is just unbelievable, all because I go over there and try to make lives better.
And I think that's so awesome that what you're doing, Dr. Joanne. And I think that how did you get involved in the organization? What did somebody direct you into it to specifically? Tell us a little story of that.
Yes, my mom.
Oh, and you know, last night, Neil, I spoke with Joanna, just a friend call, and we were talking, and I said, you know, who is the woman that empowers you the most? And Joanna, easily, the first person that came out of her mouth was, my mom. So let's hear about this empowered woman, your mom, who helped you get that way.
Well, back when Tanzania was forming independence, she actually decided to run off to Africa with my dad and become teachers. So they did. And that is both one of the reasons she is one of the people that has inspired me, but it's also my connection there. And one of the reasons I do the work I do is because I believe in finding effective poverty reduction strategies. I believe in empowering women. I believe in building I believe in building educational facilities that all people can go to. I believe that when half of our planet is not able to work or be recognized, the women, then, or own things or be able to be valued for their simple existence, then I think we're doing ourselves a disfavor as a culture. And unfortunately, that happens all too often. I think if we want to survive economically, if we want to survive socially, if we want to simply be human beings, we need to make sure that we include all of us in that. And quite frankly, it's important that to simply reach out and say, we're all part of this together. Our disease systems are linked. Our economies are linked. Our humanity is linked. If one country goes down, we all go down. So let's work together to make this possible. And that's what we did in the marathon, and that's what I do globally.
I love it. I'm thrilled by what you're saying, because it is just it's a vision that you have that is really being seen through. It is this sort of global empowerment and inspiring other women, whether they're on doing the Boston Marathon and something happens, or if they're in Tanzania walking miles to get to a phone to call you. They're reaching out because you've made a difference in their life. I know that, like, for me, I've been going through some things in my own life that have been a little tricky, and I have just been overwhelmed with the support of people that over the decades I've been reaching out and, you know, quietly helping them, and all of a sudden it's like this rush of love and support, and you can do this, Shelley, and we can make it through together. Joanna, you were one that picked up the phone right away and contacted me. So I appreciate that, and I can see why those people would walk so far and take pains to get to you to make sure that you are okay, because you're very important in their lives.
Reaching out is something that's so easy, and yet I think we forget that we can do it. We don't give ourselves enough permission to be involved in our society and to actually actively create the society we want. We leave it to people that have hero in their job description, like our firefighters and our military.
Right.
And, you know, but they are heroes, but they don't need to be the only ones, as we can see, you know. And we leave the reaching out to people who have foundations, like, you know, like me. But we forget that reaching out is so easy. And you do it every single day to the person next to you.
Yes, it can be as simple as a smile or a hug or a pat on the back, or, you know, it can be that simple. Or it can be with me and my daughter when we go to the homeless shelter to help out, you know, playing with the babies and getting them blankets and things like that. So, I mean, I think that it can take on so many forms. And I think there's so many people out there that still feel like, well, I don't have enough money to help, or, well, you know, I don't have enough time. And I think that mindset can slow us down from making progress, as you say, as a society. And we need to pull away from that and create time and create opportunities that might not require the money from us, or that we could fundraise to, so that we don't have to come to the table with all the money. We can use our skill sets. So I really applaud you, and I'm sure Neil is feeling the exact same way. What are your thoughts now, Neil?
Well, absolutely. I'm amazed at starting your own foundation and being involved in helping Africa, especially the country you're working with. One of the things I wanted to ask is specifically, let's look at the components of how you empower women. Educationally, what types of things do you do educationally to empower women with your organization?
We not only do we build schools, but we also do, you know, for the schools, we do skills training, pure education programming. We also do sanitation and economics. We do microloan programs. We grade roads. We build hospitals, clinics. We do medical supplies. What else? Agricultural, cooking, all sorts of trades. Let's see. We've rebuilt villages.
Well, you do a lot. And Dr. Shelley, it must mean that she spends a lot of time on this foundation. It seems like there's a lot, and she needs a lot of help from others, especially financial help. Isn't that true, Dr. Shelley?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think that just knowing Dr. Zoena, that she has formed some wonderful networks globally to help with those. But we definitely want to put the word out too. And that's another huge
Absolutely.
Component of Inspiring Lives, is that I want people out there to know that they can help. So where would they be able to go to help Moyo International?
Oh, absolutely. You know, right now we are currently at www.weece, which is weece.org. That's www.weece.org. And we will be turning into moyointernational.org, which is M-O-Y-O international.org as of May 1st. And we will continue to run these phenomenal microloan programs, bank seeding, educational, everything under the sun, everything we're doing, and more. And we have more partners now, including we're going to have our own legal department with legal advocacy, counseling, trauma, all again to empower women and children in Tanzania, and hopefully with this entire holistic poverty reduction model, we're going to be able to move it throughout the world.
I absolutely love it. Fantastic work.
And absolutely, and we definitely also can help with the part of my organization, Total Education Network and Beach Lifestyle Media Group. I am part of Mission G, a foundation that helps other foundations, so we'll make sure we can have some dialogue with my business partner about how we can help each other out in specific ways with both each other's foundations. And so that's the other thing why Dr. Shelley and I have come together again. I've become more philanthropic in my ventures since the first time I met her 3 years ago, and I'm really excited to meet these great people like yourself that are really giving back to help others. Isn't that true, Dr. Shelley?
Absolutely. And we are just thrilled to all be in this together. And we hope that people will continue to tune in to Empowering Women. And Dr. Joanna, do you have any closing remarks for us today?
I do. I just want to remind people that every single moment is your own personal point of power. There is nothing that you can't do in that moment, and that at some point in our lives, we're all going to go through something. Use that as an opportunity to reach out. Let somebody know. If it's you, let somebody know that you need help.
Yes.
Because everybody out there is going to be willing to help you. The world is full of heroes and angels.
Yes.
And they're all standing next to you. And if you want to create a better society, then you take part in that too. Because it is so easy to mindfully do it.
And Joanna, I want to commend you for coming on, especially with such a traumatic thing like this happening, and to be able to talk this early to the media about what happened. And our prayers go out to everyone that has gone through this trauma at the Boston Marathon, and luckily you guys as a community really worked together to defeat what this terrorist attack ended up becoming, that you won because you would not allow yourselves to be defeated. And that's everyone from the first responders to everyday people. So I appreciate you calling, and we'll definitely keep you in our prayers.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to sign off here, and this is Dr. Shelley Hipsky with Empowering Women and with Neil Haley, and I would just like to remind you all that inspiration is just a story away.
We're back to the Total Education Spotlight Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. The Spotlight Show, again, we talk all education on the Spotlight Show. I can't even describe it sometimes, especially when we've had situations with different causes and kids that are dealing with certain situations and parents. But I always am excited to have Ed World on the show for their Education World for their monthly segment. So I want to welcome the program, Diana Motzinger, and you're from Edmond, Inc. Diana, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks so much for letting me have a chance to speak with you guys today.
Well, your expertise is amazing, and I'm really excited to talk to you about, again, everyone's talking about, you know, the Common Core standards, and, you know, and there are so many teachers out there concerned, but it seems like what you have to talk about today is really going to give us an understanding of where we're going in education, especially involving testing, when there's a lot of, I guess, rebellion against testing right now through the public, in public opinion. Wouldn't you agree?
There's always going to be debate about testing because it's by nature a contentious sport. And any time that politics goes to only having one form of testing, it creates a lot of doubt and uncertainty. So, you know, we just have to remember that in addition to the Common Core assessments, there's always going to be other types of ways that we are going to need to assess kids to make sure they're making expected progress. But yeah, the big Common Core coming up, it's a huge mandate, and it's putting people under a lot of pressure.
And it definitely is. And but I'm glad to hear specifically what's happening, how testing's going to change from the days of NCLB in certain ways. I guess meaning like the way testing was before the Common Core standards. Am I correct? We're going to see a different type of testing, and then I have some questions that I know that you want to cover in this interview, but that's going to be a good thing in the long run, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The new Common Core standards are a little bit more evolved than the earlier state standards, and it does have a cohesive quality to it that we haven't seen before. It may help for kids that move around from place to place, and it may help teachers in education programs to be working in a more, more common and easily understood way. The tests themselves are what is being contended right now. There are two consortia, the SBAC Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium and the PARC consortia that are the two main entities that are driving this big assessment. And so it's about a half and half with about five or six states that are not involved. They just are opted out. Those are Virginia and Texas. And now there's a couple other states who are saying, well, whoa, Nelly, what are we doing? Because the tests have to be all online. They have to be, they're much harder in terms of some of the ways that we've tested in the past and what they're asking students to do. And there's just some general concern about things that are the way that the test will be done. So it's a little higher stakes than it seems like it's been before.
And would you say that now it's more like the tests that college kids take, high school kids take to get to college? Do you think it's changing in that aspect compared to first? I think the tests were developed before just to see that specifically we can make sure we have enough kids that passed through in most areas, that it was not a very complex, difficult test. Do you think now they're looking at specifically other standardized tests that are used to measure intelligence and also measure the ability to be prepared for college and kind of align it to what this test is like, would you say, in your opinion?
In my opinion, the tests that they'd like to create require a pretty advanced psychometric and cognitive understanding. They're trying to see how deeply kids can think and then also express what they know. And so the depth of knowledge that they're looking for is something that they've not been able to capture with an A, B, C, D, multiple choice, single response type of a test, which is great for, those kinds of tests are really great for mass quantities of people taking a test. They're easy to score, and they can be, the vast amount of information can create some pretty solid value. So these new tests, they have a lot different style. They have this aspect that's called performance tasks, where they are asking kids to do a number of increasingly complex actions to demonstrate their depth of knowledge around questions. So those are good. That's a lot more difficult than a multiple choice test. And then the essay questions are the same. That's really where the rubber meets the road. And what they're trying to do is figure out ways, I say they, I don't know that anyone's really solved this yet, but to computer score a constructed response or essay question, and that's just outside of the realm, because teachers really have been scoring those historically.
Very interesting.
So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm taking my thought process in this whole thing that, again, when you're talking about a series of tasks, give me an example. Are they like project-based type learning kind of things where you have to take your basic prior knowledge and background knowledge of something and make it real world to connect? Is that the kind of – give me an example of what you talk about when you're talking about these tasks that they'll have to complete compared to bubbling and answers.
Well, there are – if you look on – if you Google the Common Core assessment sample items, you can find some examples of these tests in reading. Just so you know, these tests are only going to be administered in reading and in math initially, for grades 3 through 11. A typical test question might be a photograph or a number of photographs, and then the student is asked somewhat is considered low-level depth of knowledge questions that establish that the student has the essential underlying knowledge to answer the questions. And then there might be a constructed response question where the student is asked to analyze the images and to make a hypothesis about what's happening in the picture. And then there might be a third task. It's a series of questions and answers that they have to manipulate with drag and drop functionality on the page. They have to respond to the online test in a much more natural way than just filling in the blank. These are not bubble in the answer kind of tests. Does that kind of answer your question?
Oh, it definitely does. And I remember hearing about it because we do cover a news show every week, Diana, and it talked about that this is all – and Jason, the public school guy, who can't say where he teaches at, but he's a good friend that was a neighbor of mine back in the day. We've been co-hosting for so long. The news show, and he told me he doesn't know how this is going to be able to be done with all these computerized tests. And some people are already starting this process. That's going to be one of the big challenges, because one of the biggest challenges is kids taking a test on a computer compared to the way we were grading before. And you don't think this is going to lead to much cheating, is it, with a computer-based test?
I don't think – I think it's there's a lot of work going into building security around the test. The biggest challenges that I think the schools are going to face regarding these assessments are, you know, the same things adults worry about every day, you know, time, money, and opportunity. We don't know. All of these tests need to be able to be taken in September of 2014, which is this coming school year.
Holy, okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt real quick. September, so they want to test these kids before they even have the year to prepare.
No, they'll have this school year coming up, and then they'll take the test. But that means 100% online testing, so that means the money problem of the infrastructure to support all the computers, to have all the kids take the tests, understand however much these tests actually wind up costing. They don't know. They don't actually know who's going to pay for it because the feds or the states haven't totally sussed that out yet. And then the opportunity question, you know, there are some children who don't know how to use a keyboard in a traditional typing way, like a QWERTY keyboard. And kids that know how to type should have an advantage over kids that hunt and peck because of just the time it takes to take a test. In addition, kids who don't have a lot of tech time may need to learn how to manage a keyboard online. So not just typing, but moving objects, dragging, dropping, doing all sorts of little simple. It seems simple to us because we do it every day, but if they don't have that background, then it'll be an issue where we have to settle down. We have to gauge validity of the answers against the equality of the access. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me, I have to jump in because this doesn't make sense to me, Diane. And remember, you don't have to make the comments that I make because, again, you're again representing an organization. But this doesn't make sense. We've already researched in the summer how much kids lose academically. To test them in September, that's a concern of mine tremendously because stuff that they learned in the school year is going to be forgotten in the summer.
Oh, no. I think – oh, I'm sorry, Neil. I think I misspoke. The test – this test will begin in September of 2014. And usually the way it's done is your test is at the beginning of the year and then again at the end of the year.
Oh, okay.
So there's a beginning of course and end of course exam. So the gain that a student sees from September to June is the issue that's it's everybody's got to get ready. You got to get your house in order.
I see. So you're looking at individual progress compared to a group progress. That's what it sounds
correct.
Like we're going, which is a great idea. And I'm sorry I jumped to that. I was thinking, oh, my gosh, how could you only have one?
Oh, yeah, because of that summer brain burn. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you never know what our federal government will do next. You just never know. So now one of the things that your organization is doing is to prepare for the Common Core state assessments. How are they doing that? What is Edmin doing?
Well, what we're doing at Edmin, we're using our test builder product that creates – it allows teachers to build their own tests using items, and we're building the same type of technology-enhanced items as will be on these, you know, end-of-year high-stakes tests. In that way, the teachers can kind of practice and familiarize their students in their formative assessments with the types of test items that they're going to be most likely to encounter on the high-stakes test. So it's not test prep because it's actually formative assessments. And I don't know if you know the difference between formative and summative, but a formative test are smaller tests that you administer throughout the year. It's sort of the equivalent of a end-of-chapter test and then the final, right?
Uh-huh.
So if we build the formative tests using our test builder IDMS product and they have the same look and feel and question types as will be on the end-of-year test, our hope is that teachers will feel that their students are well-prepared to take that test since it's a non – it isn't a voluntary situation.
Well, Diane, I think that's great because, again, this is going to be a very huge learning curve for teachers and students to be used to the paper pencil test to all computer-based tests, which hasn't gone out there, I guess, on my show that much. We talked about the computers, but I don't think everyone's ready for what's going to happen in September 2014. How are they going to deal with these things? I think it's the process of understanding the Common Core standards, and I think your organization's there to really help them in this process. And I think that it's very good to talk about the difference between the two types of assessments. Because I think if you constantly are gauging where your kids are growing throughout the year, they're going to be much better off at the end than, you know.
Well,
you go ahead.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, the beauty part of formative assessment is that it allows teachers to take the pulse on a regular basis where kids are and then adjust their teaching or give the kids other materials to help make sure that they master what they need to know as they go along instead of getting the dreaded really bad grade at the end of the course. You know, you can use it in the proper instructional cycle better than if you just have these a couple of tests twice a year. It's too rough.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Definitely look forward to have you back on, especially with you teaming up with Education World. I think we're going to really have a great monthly segment. I'm sure we'll have you back to talk about another topic. And you really educated me on certain things. I had no idea about the Common Core standards, I guess the assessment part of it, and how teaching the test will change, or I guess the preparation for the test and how it's administered will be different, and how your organization's there so that it's not such a crazy thing for teachers and students. So where can we find information on your organization?
Thanks for asking, Neil. You can go to www.edmin.com. That's EDMIN.com. And we're putting out an article about what's changing in the Common Core assessment, actually, that we're going to be releasing today. So it should be on the website in short order. Anytime. You can also just find information through Education World itself.
Well, Diana, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Had fun talking to you, and you really educated our listeners, and that's what we try to do on the Total Education Network. So thanks for calling.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, and just remember, all of this stuff happens. It'll just keep happening. We'll get through it all. We'll make some good intelligence and go forward.
Well, I think it's leading to more creativity for teachers through Common Core, and I think that now we're finally looking at individual progress, not group progress, and that's going to make it so, hey, this will really show our kids learning throughout the year. So thanks again for calling.
Thanks so much.
All right,
goodbye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Education Spotlight Show, and we'll be back.
No, my novel is called This Is the Place, and it was published in 2001, and it is now out of print, but it's available with that wonderful program that Amazon offers called New and Used. So it's still available as a used book, and I'm in the process of re-editing it, and this time I'm going to publish it on my own, I think.
Oh.
So the contract has run out with the original traditional publisher.
Well, the latest book that I have is The Frugal Editor, Put Your Best Foot Forward to Avoid Humiliation and Ensure Success. That was in 2007, and that won the U.S. Book News Award in the writing category.
Right. Well, and you're behind. I've done so much since then. I need to be sending you more books.
Oh, you need to be sending me more books and have you on the show, Carolyn. So I'm going to go with questions, Fran, and we'll learn from her. And I got a story for you, Carolyn, right before we go into that. Specifically, I was interviewing people at the Miami Book Fair live, and I was in my studio. My co-host was in Tampa, and we were in Miami. And an author didn't show up. And they threw an author we had no information on, and we were Googling throughout the show. So we understand how to kind of go with the flow, especially with authors. But I guess for our audience to understand more about you, you're basically a writing expert, correct? Would you call yourself that, a writing expert that teaches people how to write books? Am I on the right track?
Actually, I do consider myself a writing expert, and I'm not at all shy about using that word expert. But the kind of nonfiction books that I write are mostly about marketing your books once they're written, because I found that there were a really lot of stuff out there back in 2004, as Fran mentioned, when The Frugal Book Promoter first came out, about writing, but very, very little about how to make a book successful once it's written. And I had so much trouble with my traditional publisher of my novel that it immediately became clear to me that if I had trouble with a background in journalism and publicity, that the average writer who just had a background in writing was going to really have a lot of problems unless they were they were first run Simon and Schuster, but anybody on a mid list or lower was in deep trouble. So I approached UCLA and told them that I thought that people at UCLA needed more than just writing classes. They needed marketing classes, and they loved the idea. And from there on, it was history. And that happens to be my best-selling book.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about that, because Francine, again, I'm in the process of writing a book. I have the connections for publishers because of having a very successful Author's Corner show that's looking to go national syndication, not just certain terrestrial stations, but looking at L.A. markets, New York markets. In 3 months, we're going to be pitching those people because of the best-selling authors that I have on. So I want to know how to market a book, do all those different things.
You know.
Yeah, you need to know how to do that.
Pitching, for sure.
Carolyn, as it says on the back cover of your book, The Frugal Book Promotion, you love marketing almost as much as you love writing. Now,
yeah, that's almost
Neil,
being the key word, but I really do.
Marketing for authors is your number one talking point. So I know you love to speak, but not every author is comfortable as a speaker. And I know you believe in substantial handouts, but generally handouts are given at lectures. So what are some of the other marketing ploys that you can share with us?
Well, those handouts, of course, can also be offered now because of the miracle of the web, which was just getting started when I wrote my novel in 2001, can now be offered as e-books. I was just at an organization that I've spoken at several times, and I went to the meeting especially to see Penny Sansevieri. She's an excellent one for you to know too, Neil. And she was talking about handouts and about using Amazon as a tool for selling books. But then afterward, she wrote to everyone who was in attendance and offered them a free ebook on dressing up your Amazon sales page. And it was a wonderful way to, one, network with everyone who was there and thank everyone who was there, which you also know I'm big on about that thanking thing is a really important tool in terms of putting gratitude out into the world, but also in terms of networking and keeping in touch with people, you know, keeping those contacts going, keeping that publicity moving. So those handouts feel at first like something that's made of paper that you do when you're speaking or teaching, but there's all kinds of ways to get around that these days.
So that's where you go to certain talks specifically, and when you're at that talk, you hand out different information about your book so that people are able to pass that on to other people as well as learn more about it and consider the book.
Exactly, and it's a really good idea to actually offer, say at the very bottom, whether it's digital or whether it's paper, to please feel free to do exactly that. Anything that's helped you here, please feel free to pass it on to other writers that you know.
Carolyn, what do you teach at the Writers Program? Does it include marketing?
Well, actually, most of the classes that I've taught actually are marketing books, on marketing books. I've also taught a class on editing books, which in my opinion is what is your first marketing effort. Is that your book has to be well edited, because that's part of your branding, that's part of who you are, that's part of the image that you're projecting. And branding is definitely a part of marketing. But most of the classes actually are things like savvy marketing for writers, marketing online, and we can use the word marketing, we can use the word promotion, we can use the word branding, but they all come under that one umbrella of marketing.
Quite interesting. Let's go specifically why it's so important to be able to edit your book well, either hire an editor or do it yourself. The key thing is if it's not giving you that message of what you're truly trying to get out to the people. I think a lot of it has to do with your book is a marketing tool for other things as well. Not many authors are going to make $1 million.
Exactly. Because you don't know before you start how much you're going to make off from your book, you want to be very careful how much money you spend. And that's whether you're published traditionally, as Fran is, or every which way, like I am, you still aren't always sure how much any given book is going to make until you're at least well into the third, fourth, sixth month of its being on the market. So you want to budget your money carefully. And, of course, one of the problems is that people believe that if they're published traditionally, that their publisher will take care of that. And that's really only true if your name's Stephen King, let's say. You can't even trust the big guys to do a great job of marketing. There's a really interesting story out there about Stephanie Meyer, who wrote the Twilight series and was made into movies. You're probably familiar with it.
Yes.
And she had a huge publisher, and she felt that they were going kind of in the wrong direction from the way she wanted to go with marketing her book. So this hit the business page of the LA Times. She just took it into her own hands, even though they had supplied, as an example, a gorgeous website for her. She set up another one with a different slant to it. And then she started talking to different bloggers who blog YA, meaning young adult blogs, and offering something up about whatever topic they were talking about, and then talking a little bit about each of her books. And she feels that practically single-handedly, she forced that onto her first book onto the New York Times bestseller list. That before that, it was kind of languishing. So we are, in fact, in charge, no matter how our book is published, in charge and in control of the success of our own books. And too many authors really think that they don't have to do anything, or that they can't, which is even worse. So that's why I got so charged. And as friends, I like it so much. I love marketing because I'm helping authors, right?
In other words, she used the internet.
Exactly.
And that's how a book got noticed.
Exactly. And, of course, you can reach so many people with the internet. It used to be postcards and speaking and, you know, one-on-one. And the internet allows you to reach so many people at once.
Well, here's a good question about that. I like the idea what you said. She went and tapped into groups like blogging groups and different messaging boards and things like that. I think a lot of people think, as long as I post it on Facebook or Twitter, everyone's going to see it. I don't need to spend but maybe 30 minutes a day marketing via internet. That's absolutely wrong. You got to put a lot of time and effort and have a game plan. Am I correct?
Absolutely. You know, again, in the old days, no one blinked an eye. No author blinked an eye if their publisher said, hey, I'm going to send you on a six-month book tour, and you're going to have to hit every single major city in the United States and maybe some overseas as well. And, you know, that was part of what was expected, and they just bucked up and did it. But today, most big publishers don't do that, or at least not for very many of their authors, because they're struggling with the bottom line too. So that leaves it up to them and the author to find another route to achieve the same results. And in my opinion, the web is the way to go, and they'll achieve even more than they would have with those book tours.
Yeah, getting back to marketing.
Book tours are not the way to market anymore. It's the web.
Getting back to marketing, since I know you, Carolyn, you've won awards for yourself and for your books. And do you think that entering one's books for awards is a good marketing ploy?
Absolutely. You know, when you go into a bookstore, which we still have a few of those, but we also open a web page and we see that a book has... this book has won an award, and this book has not. We only know that we want a book on marketing, or that we want a romance novel, or whatever. For many authors, there's two ways to really determine which of those books they would prefer to buy. The one is reviews, and that's being diluted by for all sorts of reasons today. And the other one is if it's won an award. So.
But how has it helped your books? How does it help promote your books?
Immeasurably. When my books win an award, I put it on my web. I tell people in my query letters when I'm querying them for a show like this. I didn't need to...